Chapter 8. Twilight in Eden. Minoan Crete and Eleusinian Mystery. In the absence of a partnership community, and with the loss of the psychoactive plants that catalyze and maintain partnership, nostalgia for paradise appears quite naturally in a dominator society. The abandonment of the original catalyst for the emergence of self-reflection and language, the Stropharia cubensis psilocybin-containing mushroom, has been a process with four distinct stages. Each stage represents a further dilution of awareness of the power and the numinous meaning resident in the mystery. The first step away from the symbiosis of the human-fungal partnership that characterized the early pastoralist societies was the introduction of other psychoactive plant substitutes for the original mushroom. This psychoactivity can range from being equal in the depths of its profundity to the Stropharia cubensis psilocybin intoxication, as in the case with the classical hallucinogens of the New World tropics, to being relatively trivial. Examples of the latter are the use of ephedra, a stimulant, and fermented honey as soma substitutes. Abandonment of the mystery. In the case of Stropharia cubensis in Africa, a gradual trivialization scenario is reasonable. With changes in climate, frequent if not continual low levels of mushroom ingestion gradually gave way to use that was merely seasonal. Conscious ceremonial use of mushrooms must have been at its apex during the seasonal availability phase, which may have lasted many thousands of years. Gradually, as mushrooms and mushroom ecologies grew more rare, there may have been efforts to preserve the mushrooms by drying and by preserving them in honey. As honey itself easily ferments into an alcoholic intoxicant, it is possible that over time a practice of mixing fewer and fewer mushrooms in more and more honey may have encouraged replacement of the mushroom cult with a cult of mead. No greater shift of social values is possible to imagine than that which would accompany the gradual changeover of a psilocybin cult to an alcohol cult. Such gradual profanation of a psychoactive plant sacrament merges easily into the second step in the abandonment of the original psychosymbiotic mystery. The second step is the substitution of completely inactive materials for active ones. In this situation, the substitutes, though usually still plants, are really no more than symbols of the former power of the mystery to authentically move initiates. And in the third stage of the process, symbols are all that is left. Not only are psychoactive plants now out of the picture, but plants of any sort have disappeared, and in their place are esoteric teachings and dogma, rituals, stress on lineages, gestures, and cosmogonic diagrams. Today's major world religions are typical of this stage. The third stage leads into yet another stage. This other stage is, of course, the complete abandonment of even the pretense of remembering the felt experience of the mystery. This last stage is typified by secular scientism as perfected in the 20th century. We could perhaps even posit a further aspect of this fourth stage in the process of abandonment, the rediscovery of the mystery and its interpretation as evil and threatening to social values. The current suppression of psychedelic research and the hysteria fanned by pharmaphobic media is an obvious case in point. The discussion of Minoan civilization and the mystery cults it spawned and sheltered takes us to the domain of the plant substitutes for Stropharia cubensis psilocybin. These were powerful cults with powerful plants to aid in the formulation of a religious ontology, but in all likelihood they were not directly dependent on sources of psilocybin for the attainment of ecstasy. In Minoan Crete and still later at Eleusis on the Greek mainland, hallucinogenic indoles of other types were admitted as techniques of ecstasy. Cultural and climatic conditions made the original source of the boundary-dissolving psilocybin ecstasy no more than a memory, and its image no more than a symbol. The Fall of Cattle-Hayuk and the Age of Kingship. James Mellart, the principal investigator of the site, makes the point that for all its brilliance, Cattle-Hayuk had no impact on the societies around it. A disastrous series of fires swept through levels 5 and 6A around 6500 BC, and the city was abandoned, making all too clear that the age of undefended cities, the age of partnership, was ending. From then on, partnership-based social institutions and the old mother goddess religion in the Near East would witness a slow erosion and fragmentation. Refugees from the fall of Cattle-Hayuk civilization were scattered. Some few of them fled to the island of Crete. The story of Minoan civilization begins around 6000 BCE, when a small colony of immigrants, probably from Anatolia, first arrived on the island shores. These immigrants brought the goddess with them, as well as an agrarian technology that classifies these first new settlers as Neolithic. For the next 4,000 years, there was slow and steady technological progress in pottery making, weaving, metallurgy, engraving, architecture, and other crafts, as well as an increasing trade and the gradual evolution of the lively and joyful artistic style so characteristic of Crete. On the island of Crete, where the goddess was still supreme, there are no signs of war. Here the economy prospered and the arts flourished. And even when, in the 15th century BC, the island finally came under Achaean dominion, when the archaeologists no longer speak of Minoan but rather of a Minoan-Mycenaean culture, the goddess and the way of thinking and living she symbolized still appear to have held fast. The ambiance of Minoan-Mycenaean religion was one of realism, a sense of the vitality of bios and sensual celebration. The snake-handling Minoan nature goddess is representative of all these values. In all Minoan depictions, her breasts are full and bare, and she handles a golden snake. Scholars have followed shamanic convention and have seen in the snake a symbol of the soul of the deceased. We are dealing with a goddess who, like Persephone, rules over the underworld, a shamaness of great power whose mystery was already millennia old. Meanwhile, on the mainland of Asia Minor, the Indo-European waves of successive migration abated, and the great urban river valley civilizations arose. Kingship and chariot warfare and the travails of great male heroes now held sway in the collective imagination. Warfare and the building of fortified cities had become the enterprise of civilization. In the age of kingship, only Crete, an island and in those times remote from the events of Asia Minor, harbored the old partnership model. The mysterious Minoan civilization became the inheritor of the style and gnosis of forgotten and far-off times. It was a living monument to the partnership ideal, enduring for three millennia after the triumph of the dominator style was everywhere else complete. Minoan mushroom fantasies. The question naturally arises of the relationship of Minoan society to the archaic source of power behind the partnership ideal, namely, mushroom psilocybin. Was the old mushroom religion of the African Eden preserved and absorbed into the life of Minoan culture? Did the people still search for ecstasy but through other means in the absence of mushrooms? What are we to make of the worship of pillars that characterized Minoan religion, remembering that Soma was called Pillar of the World in the Rig Veda? It is generally assumed that these pillars are related to the great goddess religion and her vegetation cult, but could they be explicit echoes of the memory of the mushrooms? The palaces were characteristic of the style of Minoan culture, and probably were sacred in their totality, though only certain rooms were employed in the cult. On the upper floors we find several rooms, each with a single round column in the center, a column broadening toward the top, as, to cite a simple example, in the so-called temple tomb near the Palace of Knossos. The religious implications of this column cannot be doubted. Was the pillar somehow an esoteric reference to the mushroom mystery, or the last aniconic vestige of the mushroom image? Such columns were widely understood to stand for a sacred tree. The column was connected with images and rituals of vegetative significance that were very old. Was the use of mushrooms on Crete once an active and widespread cult, or was mushroom use only a memory of long-forgotten times before the arrival of the goddess worshippers on Cretan shores? The great mystery cults that coexisted in the ancient Greek world of the 4th century BC, which we call Dionysian and Eleusinian, were the last frail outposts in the West of a tradition of using psychoactive plants to dissolve personal boundaries and to gain access to gnosis. True knowledge of the nature of things that was many thousands of years old. Although they can be traced to Cretan origins, it is not clear whether psychoactive substances were a part of the celebration of the Minoan rites for the goddess. Archaeological evidence on this point is lacking. Strong cultural evidence, however, to be discussed shortly, suggests that Eleusis, that most Greek of all the mysteries, was a cult of plant-induced group psychedelic ecstasy. A curious and suggestive myth may shed some light on the problem of psychoactive plant use in the Minoan-Mycenaean context. This myth, the story of Glaucos, son of King Minos and Pasiphae, the moon goddess, has received little attention from modern scholars. It is preserved in complete form in only two late sources, Apollodorus and Hyginus. fragmented versions are found in earlier writers. Parts of the story also appear in Aeschylus' Cressai, Sophocles' Manteus, and Euripides' Polyidos. The fascination this myth had for the great dramatists suggests that it was a popular theme of the classic period. The story is old, definitely from the prehistoric phase of Greek mythological thinking. The following retelling follows the version of Apollodorus. The Myth of Glaucos. While Glaucos, the son of Minos and Pasiphae, was still a small child, he died from falling into a jar, a pithos, filled with honey, while he was pursuing a rat or a fly. The manuscripts are uncertain. Upon his disappearance, his father Minos made many attempts to find him, and finally went to diviners for advice on how he should go about his search. The Charites answered that Minos had among his herds a cow of three different colors, and that the man who could offer the best simile for this phenomenon would also be the one to know how to restore the boy to life. The diviners gathered together for this task, and finally Polyidos, son of Corenos, compared the cow's colors to the fruit of the bramble. Compelled thereupon to search for the boy, he eventually found him by means of his powers of divination, but Minos next insisted that Polyidos must restore the boy to life. He was therefore shut up in a tomb with a dead body. While in this great perplexity, he saw a snake approach the corpse. Fearing for his own life, should any harm befall the boy's body, Polyidos threw a stone at the serpent and killed it. Then a second snake crept forth, and when it saw its mate lying dead, it disappeared, only to return with an herb which it placed on the dead snake, immediately restoring it to life. After Polyidos had seen this with great surprise, he took the same herb and applied it to the body of Glaucos, thereby raising him from the dead. Now, although Minos had his son restored to life again, he would not allow Polyidos to depart home to Argos until he had taught Glaucos the art of divination. Under this compulsion, Polyidos instructed the youth in the art, but when Polyidos was about to sail away, he bade Glaucos spit into his mouth. This Glaucos did, and thereby unwittingly lost the power of divination. This must suffice for my account of the descendants of Europa. Let us attempt to analyze this peculiar story. First of all, it is necessary to comment on the significance of the names of the two main characters. Polyidos is clearly the man who has many ideas, and Glaucos simply means blue-gray. The meaning of Glaucos was, for me, the entry point into the intention of the myth. It is well known among mycologists that the flesh of Stropharia cubensis and other psilocybin mushrooms has the property of staining a bluish color when bruised or broken. This blue staining is an enzymatic reaction, and a fairly reliable indicator of the presence of psilocybin. Glaucos, the youth who is preserved in the jar of honey, seems symbolic of the mushroom itself. Indeed, Wasson mentions the frequent allusions to honey in connection with soma in the Rig Veda. He rejects the notion that mead, the fermented form of honey, could have been the basis of soma. Honey, madhu, is mentioned frequently in the Rig Veda, but mead, never. Honey is cited for its sweetness and also is often applied as a metaphor of enhancement to soma. There is reason to think that it was used on occasions to mix with soma, but the two were never confused. Honey and opium. The antiseptic properties of honey have made it a preferred medium among many peoples for the preservation of delicate foods, and in Mexico, honey has long been used to preserve psilocybin-containing mushrooms. The fact that Glaucos, the blue-gray one, fell into a honey pot, whose shape suggests the bucket-shaped graves of the Natufians, and was preserved there until the time of his resurrection seems highly suggestive. Herodotus mentions that the Babylonians preserved their dead in honey, and the use of large storage vessels or pithoi for burying the dead was widespread in the Bronze Age Aegean. The motif of cattle is present in the story in the bizarre section concerning the simile of the three-colored cow, and the need to demonstrate linguistic facility as a precondition to being able to find the lost child. And the serpent, familiar from the Genesis story of Eden, makes a cameo appearance, and once again proves to have accurate and secret information concerning plants, especially plants that confer immortality. Polyidos, the shaman figure, uses the information gained from the serpent to return Glaucos to life. He shares his shamanic understanding with the boy, but later, all the information leaves Glaucos and returns to his departing teacher. This may refer to the elusive nature of the visions glimpsed during mushroom intoxication. The story is obviously garbled in this version, and the simile contest regarding the three-colored cow hardly makes sense. Yet all the motifs of a barely remembered mushroom cult are there. Themes of death and rebirth, cattle, serpents with herbal knowledge, and a blue-gray child who is preserved in honey. A parallel example is provided by the mushroom cults of the New World. Throughout their range in Mesoamerica, the psychoactive mushrooms are thought of as small children, Los Niños, the dear sweet little ones, Maria Sabina, the mushroom shamaness of Huatla de Jimenez called them. This is an instance of the motif of the alchemical children, the elfin denizens of some nearby magical continuum, accessed through psilocybin. We may never know with certainty the role that hallucinogenic fungi and plants had in the Minoan world. Much can change over the length of nearly 4,000 years, and we know from the scholarship of Karenyi and others that the late Mycenaean Minoan civilization was more fascinated by opium than by psychedelic plants. It may be presumed that toward the end of the late Minoan period, opium stimulated the visionary faculty and aroused visions which had earlier been obtained without opium. For a time, an artificially induced experience of transcendence in nature was able to replace the original experience. In the history of religions, periods of strong medicine usually occur when the simpler methods no longer suffice. Opium was consonant with the style of Minoan culture and helped to preserve it. When Minoan culture came to an end, the use of opium died out. This culture was characterized by an atmosphere which in the end required such strong medicine. The style of Minoan bios is discernible in what I have called the spirit of Minoan art. This spirit is perfectly inconceivable without opium. The openness of Minoan society to the inclusion of opium in its religious rites is indicative of a willingness to associate ecstasy and the pursuit of altered states of consciousness with plant alkaloids. It is therefore a strong argument that other plants may have been utilized originally. The Dionysus Connection. Dionysus, son of Zeus and the mortal Semele, twice born, god of intoxication who brings madness to women, has never been a comfortable figure in the Greek pantheon. There is something older, wilder, and strange that hovers about him. He is a vegetation god, a mad god, and a dying god, a god of orgy, androgyny, and intoxication. And yet more, for from his miraculous birth onward, his story contains unique elements. Dionysus was twice born because his mother died, consumed in a lightning storm before she could give birth. The father did not let his son perish. Cooling ivy tendrils protected him from the heat by which his mother was consumed. The father himself assumed the role of the mother. He took up the fruit of the womb not yet capable of life and placed it in his divine body. And when the number of months was accomplished, he brought his son into the light. This notion of the twice-born god anticipates the mystery of the Christos in ways scholarship has not fully explored. Only in the late phase of Greek culture was Dionysus transformed into the god of wine and drunken revelry. The older stratum of material is darker and touched with the bizarre. Semele was thought to be one of the four daughters of King Cadmus of Thebes, according to Graves. A clue to the Minoan connections surrounding Dionysus is the fact that Semele, though mortal, was accorded her own special cult honors as a goddess. The rites of Dionysus as practiced on the island of Mykonos were deeply entangled with rites that honored his mother. Scholars have in fact reconsidered Semele's mortality and decided that she may have been a goddess all along. Kretschmer pointed out that Apollodorus equated Semele with Ge, the Thracian form of Gaia. In the older stratum, the Minoan stratum, Dionysus is the son of the great mother goddess and is totally subservient to her. A point of view sensitive to the polarity of the partnership versus dominator relationship in the ancient world and of the change from one to the other cannot fail to see this as an important clue. Is not Dionysus in his androgyny, in his madness, in his personification of ecstatic intoxication, the image of the spiritual crises that overcame the Minoan archaic ideal? A male god, but softened by the androgynous values of Gaian culture, a dying god, personifying the death agony of the symbiotic relationship to vegetation that male dominance, Christianity, and the phonetic alphabet would finally overthrow. A god comprehensible only to initiates, usually women in the cult, and from the point of view of the patriarchy, something wild, ancient, and potentially dangerous. The Dionysian theme entered staid Greece from the south, from island cultures with roots 10,000 years deep in the religion of the mushroom mother goddess. It entered from Asia Minor, but via 4 millennia of incubation within Minoan civilization. The mysteries that were planted on Grecian shores at Eleusis were the latest, last, and most baroque adumbrations of the great archaic religion of the goddess, cattle, and ecstatic intoxication by indole hallucinogens. The Mystery at Eleusis. Each September, for 2,000 years that more than span the classical Greek and Roman civilizations, a great festival was celebrated on the Eleusinian plain near Athens. In that place, tradition held, the goddess Demeter had been reunited with her daughter, Kore or Persephone, who had been abducted into the netherworld by its lord and ruler Pluto. These two goddesses, seeming sometimes more sisters than mother and daughter, are the two great figures around which the Eleusinian mysteries were celebrated. The Festival of the Mysteries was held on two occasions during the Athenian year. The lesser mystery, celebrated in the spring, to welcome the return of vegetation, anticipated the great mysteries, celebrated at harvest time. The mysteries were clearly connected to Minoan rites. The oldest telesteria, cult structures, are pre-Hellenic. The name Eleusis suggests pre-Hellenic Crete. Certain cult vessels, the kernoi and libation jugs, are common to Eleusinian and Minoan cults. The form of the telesteria may possibly be a further development of the so-called Minoan theater. The anacteron is the same as the Cretan repositories and so-called house chapels. The purifications of the Eleusinian cult come from Crete, where they originally belonged to the Minoan religion. The kernel of the mysteries is a cult of fertility, which is also the kernel in the Minoan religion. A double ancient tradition traces the mysteries to Crete. On the one hand, Diodorus, who stands independently, on the other, the Homeric Hymn to Demeter. These conclusions, established nearly 20 years ago, have since been adopted by leading historians of religion. The correctness of the interpretation, achieved without the more intimate knowledge of the basic content of the Minoan religion which we now have, is further strengthened by the present research. Though Eleusis has commanded the attention of many scholars, we still do not have a definitive understanding of exactly what it was that gave the mystery a power over the Hellenistic imagination, such that for nearly 2,000 years, literally everyone who is anyone made their way to the great harvest festival celebrated on the plain of Athens. The French historian of religion, Le Clerc de Sechen, writing toward the close of the 18th century, put it this way. According to Cicero, people came from all quarters to be initiated here. Is there a single Greek, says Aristides, a single barbarian so ignorant, so impious, as not to consider Eleusis as the common temple of the world? That temple was built at a town in the neighborhood of Athens, on the ground that had first yielded the bounties of Ceres. It was remarkable for the magnificence of its architecture, as well as for its immense extent, and Strabo observes that it would contain as many people as the largest amphitheater. The power of Eleusinian mysteries lay in the fact that they possessed no dogma, but rather involved certain sacred acts that engendered religious feeling and into which each successive age could project the symbolism it desired. Orthodox scholars, themselves unfamiliar with the reality-transforming power of plant hallucinogens, have fallen victim to the prejudiced attitude toward ecstasy that typifies the constipated patriarchal academy and hence have been baffled by the mystery. And their bafflement has produced some of the most tortured of speculations. Albrecht Dietrich presumed that the object taken from the chest and in some way manipulated by the mysties was a phallus. This, however, met with the objection that Demeter was, after all, a female deity. Alfred Cort was therefore much applauded when he announced that it must be a female sexual symbol. Now everything seemed clear as day. By touching the womb, as the sexual symbol was called, the mysties was reborn, and since such an act must, after all, have constituted the climax of the mysteries, Ludwig Nowak went so far as to assume that the Hierophant displayed this womb to the congregation in a blaze of light, and that, beholding it, the initiates could no longer doubt their beatific lot as children of the goddess. It is difficult to report such notions without a smile. Indeed, displaying a representation of the vagina might have riveted a room full of male Victorian classicists, but one would like to believe that the mystical wellspring of the classical world was something more than a peep show. A psychedelic mystery? There's little doubt that at Eleusis something was drunk by each initiate, and each saw something during the initiation that was utterly unexpected, transformative, and capable of remaining with each participant as a powerful memory for the rest of their life. It is an incredible testament to the obtuseness of the scholars of the Dominator Society that not until 1964 did someone make bold to suggest that a hallucinogenic plant must have been involved. That person was the English poet Robert Graves in his essay, The Two Births of Dionysus. The secret which Demeter sent around the world from Eleusis in charge of her protege, Triptolemus, is said to have been the art of sowing and harvesting grain. Something is wrong here. Triptolemus belongs to the late 2nd millennium BC, and grain, we now know, had been cultivated at Jericho and elsewhere since around 7000 BC. So Triptolemus's news would have been no news. Triptolemus's secret seems therefore concerned with hallucinogenic mushrooms, and my guess is that the priesthood at Eleusis had discovered an alternative hallucinogenic mushroom easier to handle than Amanita muscaria. One that could be baked in sacrificial cakes, shaped like pigs or phalloi, without losing its hallucinogenic powers. This was the first of many observations Graves made on the underground tradition of mushroom use in prehistory. He suggested to the Wassons that they visit Mazatecan Mexico for evidence supporting their theories on the impact of intoxicating mushrooms on culture. Graves believed that recipes and classical sources for the preparation of the ritual Eleusinian beverage contained ingredients whose first letters could be arranged to spell out the word mushroom, the secret ingredient. Such a cipher is called an ogham, after the similar poetic device in use in Irish riddlery and poetics. Graves readily grants that, "You are at liberty to call me crazy," but then goes on to defend his thesis very well. Perhaps we shall never know the nature of the hallucinogenic plants that lie behind the Eleusinian mystery, or that propelled the celebrants of Dionysus into a frenzy that was overwhelming to experience and frightening to behold. Graves, having opened the way to speculation on the botanical reality behind the Eleusinian sacrament, then had the pleasure of seeing his friend Wasson stride down that newly opened avenue of thought with a bold and convincing theory. The ergotized beer theory. Wasson's notion, worked out in collaboration with his fellow sleuths Albert Hoffman and Carl Ruck, and unveiled at a mushroom conference in San Francisco in 1977, was that Eleusis was a rite of visionary intoxication, but mushrooms were not directly involved. Wasson gave cogency to much that had previously been obscure by arguing that the source of intoxication was an ergotized beer brewed from a strain of ergot fungus. Some background is necessary to appreciate the neatness of this suggestion. Grain was somehow very important to the cult at Eleusis. The Festivals of the Mysteries was a harvest festival, as well as the celebration of a great agricultural secret and a mystery of the mother goddess and Dionysus. Claviceps purpurea, a small fungus that infects edible grains, produces ergot, a source of powerful alkaloids capable of causing hallucination, as well as of triggering the onset of labor and having a strong vasoconstrictive effect. The purple traditionally associated with the robe of Demeter may signify the distinctive purple color of the sclerotic, the ergot of commerce, which are purple and are an asexual resting stage in the life cycle of the organism. Mycelium sprouts from them and aggregates to form the spore-containing acai, which do look like tiny mushrooms, but they are not purple but rather light bluish. Arguing for their theory, Wasson and his colleagues wrote, "Clearly, ergot of barley is the likely psychotropic ingredient in the Eleusinian potion. Its seeming symbiotic relationship to the barley signified an appropriate expropriation and transmutation of the Dionysian spirit, to which the grain, Demeter's daughter, was lost in the nuptial embrace with earth. Grain and ergot together, moreover, were joined in a bisexual union as siblings, bearing at the time of the maiden's loss already the potential for her own return and for the birth of the phalloid son, the mushroom, that would grow from her body. A similar hermaphroditism occurs in the mythical traditions of the grotesquely fertile woman, whose obscene jests were said to have cheered Demeter from her grief just before she drank the potion." Wasson and Hoffman's theory is bold and well argued. Certainly their discussion of the scandal of 415 BC, in which the Athenian noble Alcibiades was fined for having the Eleusinian sacrament in his home and using it for the entertainment of his friends, makes clear to even the most resistant skeptic that whatever the catalyst for ecstasy at Eleusis was, it was tangible. The notion that Eleusinian rites were celebrated with ergotized beer is entirely consistent with the notion that they had historical roots in Minoan Crete. In 1900, Sir Arthur Evans, excavating near the Palace of Knossos, unearthed vessels adorned with ears of barley in relief. He therefore assumed that a kind of beer had preceded wine on Crete. Kareni believes that the small size of these vessels indicates that they were used for a special kind of barley drink, the visionary sacrament of the Eleusinian mysteries, in rites allegedly performed without secrecy at Knossos. Of course, the burden of proof is on those who assert, and so far as I'm aware, no one has subjected the Wasson-Hoffman theory to the acid test. That would mean the actual brewing of a superior hallucinogen from a cereal grain infected with some strain of ergot. Until this is done, the theory remains nothing more than well-argued speculation. One problem in particular needs to be dealt with. In documented instances in which large numbers of people have eaten ergot-infected grain, the result has been far from happy. Ergot is toxic. In AD 994, an outbreak of ergotism associated with infected grain killed nearly 40,000 people in France. An outbreak in 1129 killed about 1,200 people. Recently, the historian Mary Kilbourne Matassian has argued that La Grande Pire of 1789, a peasant uprising pivotal in the French Revolution, had its roots in ergot-infected rye bread that constituted the bulk of the diet of the rural peasantry of the period. It has also been proposed that ergot-infected flour was a factor in the decline of the Roman Empire and in the Salem witch burnings. The following summarizes the apparent effects of ergotism. Two clinical types of ergotism have been described, the gangrenous and the convulsive. Gangrenous ergotism started with tingling in the fingers, then vomiting and diarrhea, followed within a few days by gangrene in the toes and fingers. Entire limbs were affected by a dry gangrene of the entire limb, followed by its separation. The convulsive form started the same way but was followed by painful spasms of the limb muscles, which culminated in epileptic-like convulsions. Many patients become delirious. Clearly, unpleasant experiences may lie ahead for those who set out to prove by self-experiment the Wasson-Hoffman theory concerning Eleusis. There are old mycologists, and there are bold mycologists, but there are no old bold mycologists. As with Wasson's theory of the identity of Soma, the problem is to obtain a reliable intoxication from the assumed source of the intoxicant. If the source of the Eleusinian mystery was ergotized beer, how could it have been taken for so many centuries without unpleasant side effects becoming a part of the legend? There may be a way around these difficulties. Claviceps paspalli, which preferentially infects barley instead of rye, may have a higher proportion of the psychoactive but less toxic simple ergot alkaloids, similar to those in morning glories, and a lower proportion of the toxic peptide-containing ergot alkaloids. Also, as Wasson and Hoffman reported in The Road to Eleusis, macerating the ergotized grain in water would effectively separate the water-soluble psychoactive alkaloids from the fat or liposoluble toxic alkaloids. Graves's psilocybin theory. Should future research indicate that ergot played no part at Eleusis, then Graves's insistence that psilocybin mushrooms constituted the mystery would need to be looked at very carefully. Perhaps knowledge of the plant of the goddess, Stropharia cubensis, or some other psilocybin-containing mushroom did survive, not only into Minoan-Mycenaean times, but even up until the final destruction of Eleusis. Whatever its nature, the Eleusinian sacrament commanded the greatest respect and even love of the classical writers who invoked it. Happy is he who, having seen these rites, goes below the hollow earth. For he knows the end of life, and he knows its God-sent beginning, wrote the Greek poet Pindar. With the passing of Eleusis, the great broad river of partnership, goddess worship, and hallucinogenic ecstasy that had flowed for over 10,000 years sank at last into that thonic realm reserved for forgotten religions. Christianity's triumph ended the glorification of nature and planet as supreme spiritual forces. What Eisler called the triumph of the blade of dominator social models of paternalism and patriarchy was everywhere complete. Only a dim echo of the old ways continued to reverberate in the form of such underground concerns as alchemy, hermeticism, midwifery, and herbalism. A historical watershed. With the eclipse of the Minoan Crete and its mysteries, humankind crossed a watershed into the progressively more vacant, more ego-dominated world, whose energies were coalescing into monotheism, patriarchy, and male domination. Henceforward, the great society-shaping plant relationships of the old world's past would decline to the status of mysteries, esoteric pursuits of moneyed travelers and the religiously obsessed, and later, cynical intelligence operatives. As the mysteries faded, the phonetic alphabet helped move consciousness toward a world emphasizing spoken and written language, and away from the world of gestalt pictographic awareness. These developments reinforced the emergence of the anti-visionary dominator style of culture. The dark night of the planetary soul that we call Western civilization began.